questions answered extempore by Miss Emma Harding at the Winter Soirees, Harley Street, London, January 8, 1866. Mr. Coleman, in introducing Miss Harding, said that the evening would be occupied, as previously intimated, in answering questions proposed by various ladies and gentlemen. These were numerous, and the committee had endeavored to blend those which were related to each other, but they were still too numerous to be answered on one evening. None of them had been seen by Miss Harding, whose answers would therefore be wholly unpremeditated. For the satisfaction of all, he would ask some of the ladies present to draw promiscuously four or five questions. The following questions were then drawn in the manner suggested by Mr. Coleman, and were answered in the order in which we present them. Question 1. Animals have brains and nervous systems, and exhibit phenomena, mental, moral, and emotional, which seem to differ only in degree from those of human life. They think, they reason, and invent novel and ingenious methods of attaining their objects, of overcoming their difficulties and remedying evils. They also manifest love, hatred, gratitude, revenge, joy, grief, jealousy, etc., and have also methods of communication with each other. In our superior human nature we regard these as manifestations of the spirit within us, acting through the machinery of the brain and nervous system, and we know that spirit to survive the death of our mortal part. What is it that produces these analogous, though inferior manifestations in the brute creation, and what becomes of it after their death? Answer. The first question presented requires us to define the difference between instinct and reason. It has been claimed, and justly, that the higher order of animals have a nervous system, whilst even the lower orders, in some form or other, are provided with an apparatus for the diffusion of nervous sensibility, correspondential to a system, excepting such forms of life as the mollusca, or other rudimental creatures, up to the humble worm, which exhibits a chain of ganglions, terminating in the larger one called the brain. Ranging up from the lower order of animals to the highest, we find a gradual improvement in the complexity of the nervous system, which is the apparatus which thought traverses. It is the telegraphic wire upon which the life lightnings play, addresses by EHB1, and without it the most magnificent and boundless scope of thought can never exhibit itself in matter. Consequently, it is with a special reference to the nervous system, as a physical cause, that we must first attempt to answer your question. We find that even the lowest orders of being exhibit a degree of instinct which is admirably appropriate to their condition. All the creatures of the dry land or of the water possess instincts adapted to their state. The reptile and the amphibious creature, fish and cold-blooded animals, generally are, if not fully provided with the same complex system of nerves as the mammalia, still organized with special arrangements for the generation of just the amount of vitality adapted to their state, and subservient to the instincts peculiar to that state. Yet the amount of instinct thus exhibited has never yet been classed as reason. It is, then, between the mammalia, as the highest order of animals, and man, that we must endeavor to draw the chief distinction between instinct and reason, and the question assumes a still more subtle form when we remember that the highest order of mammalia possesses a nervous system almost equal to that of man. In them, too, we find the heart, with its arterial and venous apparatus for the distribution of the circulating fluids, as elaborately developed as in the human form. We find that the brain, although it differs in quantity in different creatures, is almost as complex in its structure and convolutions as that of man. But we also find that the great column of the nervous system, the spine, with its ganglionic termination of the brain, is disposed differently in the animal to that of a man. In the animal it runs laterally with the ground, and the brain receives the galvanic power of the solar ray at an angle which varies considerably from the direct or perpendicular. Man, on the contrary, in his erect position, receives the first direct impetus from the solar ray in the action of a horizontal beam. Hence, whatever force the power of light and heat can exercise upon receptive forms, have in this attitude full scope for their exhibition, and must form a line of demarcation between the play of nervous force in the human and in the mammalia thus differently stimulated. And the next evidence of difference in degree of nervous force exhibited in form, is found in the fact that no single form in creation is capable of exhibiting the same amount of intellectual power as man. Whilst the eagle's wing can bear him upward to the sun, the power of man can transcend the eagle's flight in the mechanical powers of mind displayed in the balloon. The mole can mine, the beaver build, the ant and bee manifest the united power of the geometrician and mathematician, the wasps and the tarantula's nests are models of self-taught architecture. In short, throughout the whole range of natural history, every creature manifests a peculiarity of instinct which antedates human inventions, and emulates, in every form, the genius of man. But let it be remembered that these evidences of mental power are only exhibited in the lower creatures in one or two directions at a time. The animals which seem capable by training of enlarging the sphere of their faculties are very rare, and it is only in creatures which become the companions of, and are subject to, the intellect of man, that we realize the qualities set forth in your statement. The instincts necessary to the preservation and perpetuation of species are manifest in all living creatures alike, for instance, the love that protects their young and associates gregariously in species and tribes. The manifestations of love, hatred, jealousy, revenge, prevision, and caution, all these are displayed in every species, but their exercise is limited within its species, and comprehends nothing outside of its own nature. All species realize others antagonistic to them, comprehend that which forms appropriate element, confine themselves within their own element, yet seem to addresses by EHB to, comprehend the creatures on whom they can prey or consociate with, but none of the lower kingdom manifest evidence of an intellect outside of their own limited and defined form. Thus the building beaver, the geometrical ant, the weaving spider, and the hunting buffalo, are wonderfully instructive only in the direction of that one peculiar attribute which their form implies. The keen scent of the hound, the wonderful instincts of the migrating bird and of the hibernating animal, and even the prophetic power which teaches these creatures to lay up stores against the approaching seasons of scarcity, all this which looks so very like the action of calculating reason, when analytically considered, resolves itself at last into a necessity which grows out of the anatomy of all these creatures, and without now entering into detail, I affirm that each one is not only peculiarly adapted for the manifestation of the instinct it displays, but is as much compelled to exercise that instinct as the necessity of its form, as the flower must needs give off peculiar fragrance, and fruits or roots their quality or essence. It is far otherwise in the organism of man. This is mobile in every conceivable direction. Could the span of human life and strength extend to the physical exertion, the foot of man is capable of compassing the earth, while the power of intellect enables him to traverse it by mechanical means without the waste of time and strength either on land or air or ocean. The wild beast of the forest is unfitted for the habitations of rock. The savage tenants of the cave subsist not in the field or pasture in the meadow. Each creature is fitted only for the soil and scene in which it is found, nor has any individual of a species, instincts which direct it to enter upon any other element, scene, or sphere of action than its own. But how various and infinitely subtle are the instincts whose assemblage we call reason in man. The throbbing pulse, like the wonderful indicator of the steam engine, records the quantity and energetic action of the fires of life. Each organ works a telegraphic chain of nerves which informs the brain how much fatigue or effort man may make, how much emotion mind can well endure. The beast may feel all passions you describe, as love or hate or jealousy, or any of those feelings called emotions, yet is unable by any telegraph between the heart and the brain to determine how far its power must be controlled by judgment, intellect, or reason. It ever acts in the peculiar direction of its passions, and knows no hindrance to their play but physical exhaustion. Throughout the whole range of the human organism there is an adaptability to every circumstance, while the reason of man knits up into one, all the fragments of intellectual power that are manifest in every other creature. Thus man is a spinner, weaver, builder, engineer, and navigator. With the mariner's compass, he is enabled to guide his course over the pathless wastes of ocean better than the migratory instincts of even the swallow or the martin. By his intellect, he is enabled to calculate atmospheric changes, and to determine even centuries hence what shall be the physical aspects of nature, from what they now exhibit by the observation of the growth and formation of strata beneath his feet. There is not an element of mind, nor an atom of matter, but what is subject to man, and combined in his organism. There is not an element of mind or an atom of matter, but what is distributed amongst the animal creation, but only in diverse forms and scattered fragments. Whilst therefore we find the parts of being divided in them, in man we behold them all combined as in creation's microcosm. Then arise the questions which I would fain elaborate more fully, were there not so many other subjects of interest to consider. What shall become of this sovereign spirit of man, the totality of all other spiritual entities? And what of the fragments which constitute the life and instinct of the animal creation? Ask the realm of nature how she deals with the perfect and imperfect, the parts and whole of being. There we find that addresses by EHB3, whatsoever is perfect is preserved, while imperfection pays sin's wages, death, and passes as a fragment into higher forms to constitute a whole. Hence, while every animal is perfect in its degree, it is not perfect in relation to the highest of forms, which is man. It is only perfect as regards its own peculiar state and sphere. Here upon this earth, its being is necessary, its place is marked, but man, to whom the earth and all things of it are subjects, transcends the earth, and, therefore, belongs to spheres higher than earth. It is sometimes claimed at the spirit circle that all the forms known in the animal kingdom are found in the spirit spheres. And this is true of some spheres which contain all types of earth and which preserve the representations of every condition manifested here, from the lowest mollusca to the highest man. You can annihilate nothing, therefore you cannot annihilate the fragments of thought which vitalize and move the very humblest form. But such forms are not preserved in permanent immortality, because they are not perfect, nor susceptible of continuing an individualized existence any longer than the form which it occupies is useful to creation. Therefore, though for a time in the eternal progress of things the animal forms are preserved in something like a spiritual representative shape, these at last become extinct, even as the monsters which are no longer useful to the earth's surface have now become extinct and passed away. So for a time in the lower spheres you will find the representative forms of animals preserved, but not in the higher. There, where the perfected spirit of man dwells, there is no consociation with animal forms whatsoever. We claim that the animal spirit, then, has a continued but not an immortal existence, whilst the spirit of man, as the perfect elaboration of form, the elaboration of intellect, the cosmos that binds up all of existence known or conceived of in the universal mind, this remains forever. The imperfect dies, the beautiful and perfect, never. Question 2. Is the spirit, in its progress, incarnated more than once? Answer: the question first demands an explanation of the word incarnate. We find that its popular definition is the association of spirit with matter in the form of an animated being. Thus we may say that the spirit of the animal, the thought of which we have been speaking, is incarnate in its form. We presume that the question relates more especially to the incarnation of spirit in the human form? And to this we answer, as we ask, does the eagle return to the egg? Does the oak return to the acorn? Do the sun's rays return to its central heart of fire? Never. Whithersoever we turn our eyes, in search through the grand analogies of nature, we find that the universal genius of creation is progress. How, then, can we respond to the question that asks whether the spirit returns to the mold that shaped it? Whether the water of life returns to the pitcher broken at the fountain? Or motion to the wheel broken at the cistern? Believe it, never. The purposes of material existence are all included in the growth and development of the spirit in a material mold. We believe that the eternal spirit shakes from his divine hand the scintillations of life like star dust, and that these, precipitated in the mold of matter and associated with it, becoming incarnate spirits. But, oh, remember our claim, ever basing itself upon fundamental principles of being, addresses by E.H. Beaufort, and ever demonstrating itself in the widening revelations of spiritual unfoldings, that spirit is the power of life, not matter, that spirit is the real organism, matter only the shadowy mold in which it grows. The purposes of incarnation are simply those of growth and development. These effected, the spirit bursts its material cerements, and knows no more of incarnation. It is a spiritual body, and, as such, life's real and only substance. As a spirit, grown through matter, it is already a fully perfected being. What has it, then, to do with the clay of earth again? There is not the highest form of matter bearing an incarnate spirit now on earth that equals in its attributes the splendor of a spirit disembodied, no, not one. Whatever be the moral degradation of the disembodied soul, there are certain attributes which belong to spirit that far transcend the obstacles of matter. Clairvoyance is one of these. The darkest and most degraded of spirits, too, realizes his disembodied state with a power that belongs not even to the wisest minds of earth, for there is in the prison house of matter a veil of materiality which obstructs the vision by death removed. Hence, spirit sees no more what seems, but that which truly is. Spirit, too, is boundless. There is no time or space in its existence. In eternity all time is merged. Infinity has no horizon in the spirit world, but soul development and power to observe the boundless realm of being. In short, spirit, whether in itself, its attributes, or sphere, is so resplendent and supreme a condition, compared to matter, that the very question of reincarnation involves the whole question of retrogression, a movement nature knows not, and creation never proves. Spirit incarnate in matter, more than once, and that once as the embryo state of being only? Never. Never. The soul's nature and existence, as defined to us by the infinite spirit, whose voice we humbly and reverently re-echoed in this place some short time since, saying, I am Alpha and Omega, I am he that liveth and was dead, and, behold, I am alive forevermore, is the history of all spirit. It never dies, and therefore never returns to the material form through which it has been born into life eternal, whatever forms, in the long ages of eternity, the ascending spirit may assume, in harmony with the laws of progress illimitable, the earthly clay once spurned, the casket broken, the mold destroyed. Sooner would creation return to void and space, suns, stars, and systems be quenched in night and darkness, than spirit return to dwell in the tomb of earth, which victorious death has vanquished. Question 3. Can you give any explanation regard the suffering which the animal kingdom is called upon to endure, in connection with the physical well-being of man, and the purposes of science, as also concerning the perpetual warfare waging therein? Answer. We must first respond to that portion of the question which demands a reason for the suffering of the animal kingdom as it originates with man. We ask, why is suffering inflicted upon the animal kingdom by man? In the first place we find, that notwithstanding the supreme excellence and triumphant powers of the human soul, it still manifests its alliance with all lower existences in nature, and progresses through the realm of matter. Thus there are inevitable analogies between the influences which act on the progression of matter, the development of soul, and the forms and instincts, addresses by E.H.B. 5, of animals. Thus, in man is found the aggregated instincts of animals, and in animals the same effects of influence that act on man. Destructiveness, the love of rule, the domination of the strong over the weak, are all outgrowths in the human mind from the types in the animal kingdom. In animals and men alike, such tendencies arise from an undue excess of the love of self. There are but two primeval ideas in the realm of moral nature. These are the love of self and the love of the neighbor. Where neither of these exists in excess, they are crime; in equilibrium, they are virtue. Until man realizes the true and just balance, one or the other prevails, and hence originate all his faults and failings, and all his crimes. In the animal kingdom, which we believe to be in broken fragments, the exhibition of nature practicing to develop man, exhibiting various fragments of intellect, and displaying in various degrees the instincts, which in their totality in man, is reason, In the animal kingdom, instinct unrestrained by reason, constantly evidences a tendency to excess. In man, this excess is crime. In the animal, simply injurious instincts of nature. When we attempt to show why man inherently, as if by nature, appears desirous to inflict pain on the animal kingdom, we are painfully recalled from a consideration of the sufferings of these poor victims of our uncurbed vices, to pause on the pages of our daily journals, and there discover that man inflicts wanton acts of cruelty on a higher order of being than even the animal kingdom, and in this his hapless victims are the weak and helpless of his own race. What philosophy can show why the savage hand of violence is raised to strike a fellow creature? What sophistry can justify the haughty rule of the aristocrat over the poor and humble? Why does man trample beneath his very feet the meek sons of toil, or scorn the humble laborer? Why so often shrink, as if from a pestilence, from the ignorant, the criminal and ill-conditioned members of society, who, as cramped themselves by the chains of adverse fortune, claim from us protection, care, and teaching? All this is part of the same spirit that strikes the helpless animal, and abuses the lower creatures, and yet more problematical in view of man's high nature is the fact, that the very weakness which should claim our pity seems to be the plea on which we make it a safety valve for this our inevitable spirit of destruction, and tyranny, and wrong. In view of man's relations to the lower kingdoms, and his inheritance of violence from alliance with the brute, we assume that passion in the beast is excess of self-love in the man. Self-preservation is the column around which group all the attributes which make us men and women. Without it we cannot maintain an existence. In the excess of this feeling, which, repressed, is virtue, self-love, I repeat, is crime, and its tendency degenerates in satisfaction of our angry passions by the sacrifice of those on whom we wreak them. But your question also inquires concerning the result of ill usage upon the animal kingdom. We may not hear the moan of the creatures we punish, there may be no voice to rebuke the cruel blow with which we strike the patient steed, there is no appeal in human tone, no word of reason to remonstrate against the wanton blow we strike the brutes. But if these speechless subjects of our wrath are dumb to our mortal ear, their every wrong is a prayer which their Maker answers, and that in results which are manifestly shown in these creatures' spiritual natures. The endurance by the strong animal of wrongs inflicted by weak man, proves in the first place the total absence of that consciousness whose highest function is the knowledge of self, of its own strength, and of its relations to the oppressor. The brute knows not its power, and addresses by EHB6, therefore not itself, and in this ignorance it is that it endures. Now, we have before stated that the spirit of the lower creatures maintains a continuous existence. In this place it is proper to add, that that existence is progressive, and that the sufferings which each creature endures are its means of progress. As we strike the iron at the forge we make it finer. As we burn or beat the gold we elaborate qualities in it that are never to be found in the unwrought metal. We call forth magnetic life from stones and metals as we strike or bruise them. The fragrance of the flower ascends beneath the foot that crushes it. And even so with the suffering spirits of the creatures subject to us, the tortures which we inflict correspond to the adversities which lessen man himself. There is not a moment in our lives more fraught with instruction than the hour of bitter failure, or the moments of life's agony. 'Tis then we first begin to know ourselves, to turn our eyes within and summon up around us all the remaining energies of soul to meet the emergency. 'Tis then we come out of gladiatorial combats with life's woes, and pains, and penalties, fully developed spirits. By analogy the same process is exhibited on the spirits of the lower creatures though we mark it not. Every blow and every cruel wrong inflicted on these creatures has a corresponding effect upon their spirits. We do not say this to justify the offense of wronging them. It needs must be that offenses come, but woe unto those by whom the offense cometh. Still there is a power of transmutation in the great crucible of divine mercy which brings out the thrice refined gold from the fire of suffering wheresoever it is inflicted, and therefore it is that in the divine philosophy of suffering we are reconciled to the processes by which endurance is forced even on helpless animals, independently of the wisdom that is manifest in the system of necessary destruction which one species exercises upon another. to the destruction of noxious creatures burdensome to the earth, independently of the fact that the foul and pestilential exhalations of the earth, that would otherwise fill our atmosphere, become incarnate in these noxious creatures, and that organic life is always superior to inorganic, and the destructiveness of one species aids the progression of another. Besides all this, and the fact that through all these mutually related incidents in nature, Earth and its inhabitants are evermore progressing, 'tis strange but significant of God's creative wisdom to observe that destructiveness invariably prevails amongst the lowest forms of life, and its tendencies invariably diminish as we ascend to the higher grades of being. In the highest of all forms, the gentlest, kindest natures become more and more manifest, and the more capacity for education exists, even in the animal kingdom, the more surely is it associated with the docile disposition which preys not upon other creatures. Thus, then, do we claim, that in the ascending scale of being, destructiveness is a gradually receding tendency. It would seem to begin as a fundamental law of life's necessity, and ending, as all necessities of being end, in the fully unfolded intellect and noblest types of man. The highest reason of the highest man shall ultimately be so triumphant, that when man himself shall have learned self-government, and attained to a noble equilibrium between the love of self and the love of his neighbor, when his own superior intellect shall recognize the wrong of inflicting pain or unjust punishment on any living creature, his pure life magnetism shall go forth, and create a new earth, from the new heaven that is born within him. When man is himself a fully perfected being, and his atmosphere is radiant with his goodness, all earth will partake of his own controlling spirit life, and physical emanation. Destructiveness will cease, destructive creatures perish, the earth will become refined and purified, and the atmosphere be sublimated. The poisonous carbonic acid gas exhaled from man's addresses by EHB7, respiration descending to the ground forms now a portion of the vegetable world, and this again taken up by the animal creation, influences if not determines much of their characteristics, and thus even our respiration no less than our influential forms and lives and minds are repeated in all nature subject to our influence. When we are centers of purity, gentleness, and mercy, and that reason which legislates between the love of self and others, produces in man earth's sovereign lord, and God on earth's vicegerent, the fruits of love and wisdom, truly the bright prophetic vision of the seer shall rejoice the newborn earth in the newborn heaven of human souls that rule it. Until this glorious consummation of life's progress shall ensue, we thank our God that he transmutes our crimes into the welfare of his creatures, and from our very darkness ultimates the means of progress for creation. Question 4. Can you throw any light upon the mystery of insanity and its purposes? Answer. We will respond to the first portion of the question but must claim permission to change the phraseology of the last. We answer then by asking, what is sanity? Let us attempt to define that, ere we speak of its opposite. We take all the various moral and intellectual functions of the human mind, and we find that they may be divided into five. The first of these is manifest in the earliest period of infantile existence in the form of a sensuous nature. The tender newborn creature manifests the power of life and motion in its wailing cry of pain and unconscious appeal for sustenance. Each motion and each sound is urged by great nature's primal law, the sensuous care of self, or the yearning instincts of mere animal life and nature. With every day's advancing stage of life, as a young child grows, it manifests its second element of being in its affectional nature. We perceive the little arms of the babe outstretched to those that are ever kindest to it. We realize how readily the nurse or mother's tender love is responded to by the youngest child amongst us. Truly then, the next manifestation of human nature in the scale of mind must be affection. The next is the moral element in man. The young child no sooner takes part with its companions in its daily sports or rudimentary education than it manifests a simple sense of justice. The child in its very play cannot be trampled upon by its companions, nor venture to inflict its petty tyrannies on others. Every group of children in their sports teaches a code of morals. The next manifestation of life is the development of the intellect.